Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is Dan Trotter. Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover chapter 11 of Exodus, verses 1 through 10, a short chapter. The topic will be a final plague is threatened on the Egyptians, namely the death of the firstborn son. Our context is this: in Exodus 10, the previous chapter, we took a look at the 8th plague, which is the plague of locust, and the 9th plague, which was the plague of darkness. So we start now in Exodus 11. We'll do the first 3 verses. Now the Lord said to Moses, "One more plague I will bring on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will surely drive you out from here completely. Speak now in the hearing of the people that each man ask from his neighbor and each woman from her neighbor for articles of silver and articles of gold." The Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Furthermore, the man Moses himself was greatly esteemed in the land of Egypt, both in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of the people. Now, in verse 1, we read that the Lord said to Moses, etc., etc., etc. That verb could be rendered "had said" in the Hebrew, as Gill, Clark, and Jameson, Foss, and Brown all say. And if so, then we could place these 3 verses with the previous chapter in which Moses threatened Pharaoh with the plague of darkness. And so when in that chapter Moses said, "You'll never see my face again," he was talking about after he had finished pronouncing the plague of darkness on him. And that's okay. We'll see that some commentators take that view. Other commentators take the view that this was said later after the plague of darkness, and it doesn't matter to me one way or the other. Now this phrase where God says to Moses, "When he," Pharaoh, "lets you go," lets the people go, that phrase in the Hebrew can be read differently than that. It could be read as "when he lets you go," as one sends away a bride, i.e. laden with gifts, as the NIV Study Bible says. When he lets you go, you're going to be like a bride that's got all her presents with you. That's referring to all the articles of silver and gold that the Hebrews asked their neighbors to give them. Well, that's interesting. I don't know Hebrew, so I just take the NIV Study Bible's word for that. Now, this actually happened in the next chapter, this silver and gold plundering. Exodus 12, verse 35 and 36. Now, the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, for they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians so that they let them have their request. Thus, they plundered the Egyptians. Now, that plundering, of course, is used metaphorically. They didn't steal anything from the Egyptians. They just asked for stuff, and the Egyptians gave it to them because they wanted the Israelites to get out of town. "Sure, take my gold, take my silver, just get out of here, or we're all going to die." That's not plundering. That's not stealing. Now, God told Moses in verse 2, "Speak now in the hearing of the people." Now, Moses could not speak to 600,000 Hebrew males, and if you include the women and children, that would be 2 million or so, a whole heap of people. He probably, as Gill says, he talked to the principal family heads who then spread the words to their families, and I think that makes a lot of sense. Now in verse 3, the text says, "The Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians." That's looking ahead. That's when the Egyptians finally let them go and gave them the silver and the gold and so forth. That hasn't happened quite yet. Now, verse 3 also says that Moses himself was greatly esteemed in the land of Egypt. Well, I guess he was esteemed because of all those plagues, all those miracles that he had done. We read this in Exodus 10:7. "Then Pharaoh's servants said to Pharaoh, how long shall this man be a snare to us? Let the men go, let those Hebrew slaves go, that they may serve the Lord their God. Do you not yet understand that Egypt is ruined?" Hebrews ministers had a lot more sense than Pharaoh himself the Pharaoh's ministers had a lot more sense than the Pharaoh himself did. Moses was greatly esteemed among the Pharaoh's servants. Now, going back to verse 2 here, God asked Moses to tell the Hebrews to ask their neighbors for gold and silver. And the word there is "ask." Let each man ask from his neighbor. Now, the King James, unfortunately, translates "ask" as "borrow." So then the text would read like this. God tells Moses, "Go tell your Hebrew brethren, that they borrow articles of silver and gold from their neighbors." Borrow when they had no intention to pay them back? Well, that leaves the Israelites open to the charge of borrowing with no intention to repay, which would be immoral, and God would be asking the Israelites to do something immoral. Now, and this is despite the fact that the Hebrews were in great the Egyptians were in great arrears to the Hebrews because the Egyptians had made the Hebrews slaves, but nonetheless, that would still be immoral to do something like that. So the King James has a very unfortunate translation. It's ask, not borrow. Let me read you a quote from Adam Clark. This is certainly not a very correct translation. The original word sha'al signifies simply to ask, request, demand, require, inquire, etc. But it does not signify to borrow in the proper sense of that word, though in a very few places of Scripture it is thus used. In this and the parallel place, Exodus 12:35, the word signifies to ask or demand and not to borrow, which is a gross mistake into which scarcely any of the versions, ancient or modern, have fallen, except our own. He's talking about his own King James Version. So all you King James worshipers out there, you'll just have to live with this. Your idol is not perfect. Exodus 11, verses 4 through 6, we continue. Moses said, this is he's saying to the Pharaoh, Moses said, thus says the Lord, about midnight I am going out into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of the Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the millstones. All the firstborn of the cattle as well. Moreover, there shall be a great cry in all the land of Egypt, such as there has not been before, and such as shall never be again. Now when Moses said to the Pharaoh, again there's a dispute as to whether this is a new occasion after the ninth plague of darkness or whether it's at the very end of the plague of darkness. And the last chapter, the end of the darkness plague, Exodus 10:29, Moses said to the Pharaoh, you are right, I shall never see your face again. Well, now if he said that, we have a problem here because Moses is talking to the Pharaoh again right here in verse 4. But if you say that this is in the past perfect tense, Moses had said to the Pharaoh, and it's referring back to the end of the plague of darkness. So Moses is never going to see Pharaoh's face again, but he's going to give him a few choice parting words about the final 10th plague of the death of the firstborn. He's going to do that, and then he's never going to see his face again. So I guess this is the easiest way to reconcile this. There's other ways to reconcile it too, but we'll just say that this incident here happened at the end of the plague of darkness. John Gill agrees with this, and he says, the three preceding verses are to be read in a parenthesis, being placed here by the historian, that's Moses, as giving some light to this last discourse and transaction between Moses and Pharaoh. That's fine with me. Now, firstborn is mentioned here. We got the firstborn of the Egyptians, the firstborn of the cattle. Firstborns everywhere going down. Why is this such a big deal? Well, of course, if you have your firstborn die, that's a big deal for anybody, but especially in those ancient cultures, the firstborn is the one that has the right of primogeniture in many of those ancient cultures. The one who heads the family is basically wiping out all the family heads in Egypt, and there won't be any Egyptian social structure left. Total disaster. And it's going to be, the scope of the disaster is extensive because even the lowborn, the slave girl who sits behind the millstones watching the cows grind out the grain, a very low position in society, she's going to lose her firstborn, and the Pharaoh at the very top is going to lose her firstborn. Everybody's going to be struck with this plague. Now, it was the ultimate disaster to lose a firstborn son. All the dreams and hopes of a father are bound up in a firstborn son. The firstborn son got a double portion of the inheritance, at least in Israel. I don't know how they did it in Egypt, but firstborns dying, that's a big deal. Now, how did God kill all the firstborn in the 10th plague? Here's some options. First option is pestilence. Again, we've made a point that in many cases in the 10 plagues that God used natural means. It was the timing that was miraculous. There's nothing miraculous about flies except for when they come, or the red algae perhaps in the Nile Ocean, the gnats, the boils, all that's natural stuff. It's just the extent of it and the timing of it makes it miraculous. But here, if we say that a natural pestilence wiped out the firstborn, that doesn't work. First of all, the problem with that is that the deaths were sudden. A plague is not going to wipe you out, boom, one night you're dead. It's going to take a while for you to shuffle off the mortal coil. It would have to be an awful powerful plague to do that, and I've never heard of such. I mean, even in the bubonic plague, it took them a while to die. And not only that, the second problem is how can a plague distinguish the firstborn from other born sons? Remember, only the firstborns died. So we can't say it's a natural pestilence that did this. Well, the theologians debate, was it good angels that did it or bad angels that did it? Good angels could do it as a matter of God's judgment, but then, of course, you have a moral problem. Why would God allow good angels to kill innocent firstborn people? Because those firstborn children had done nothing wrong. Adam Clark says it could have been an evil angel, demons, that did it. And Clark throws his hands up on this issue and says, quote, whether God did this by the ministry of a good or an evil angel is a matter of little importance, though some commentators have greatly magnified it. Well, I don't think it's of little importance. I think it's an interesting question, a serious question. Did the firstborn of that little slave girl behind the millstone, did that firstborn deserve to die? Well, I don't know. You can look at all, how about in COVID-19, the pandemic that's hit the world, there's a lot of innocent people dying. If you look at this world as the ultimate end of everything, well, then no, it's not very fair. But if you look at the fact that we have this world and the next world, then if you die prematurely and you go to heaven, then it's no big deal. But the problem is a lot of these pagan Egyptians not worshiping God would go to hell. Well, then you get back to the old problem of election and predestination. They were rebelling against God at the time they died from the plague, so was it unjust for them to die? Okay, well, I'll leave that to you casuists out there to figure out the ethics of this. We will look at verse 6 now. Moses tells the Egyptians, there will be a great cry in all the land of Egypt. That was fulfilled in the next chapter, chapter 12, verse 30 of Exodus. Pharaoh arose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was no home where there was not someone dead. You can hear the wailing, the shrieking in the morning as everybody woke up. And either in the middle of the night or the next morning, and they went in, and my gosh, my firstborn son is dead. Can you imagine what a horrible disaster that was? This situation also illustrates the fact that we are all subject to people over us, and people over us can screw our lives up terribly. For example, if your parents are crack cocaine addicts and alcoholics, that's going to screw your life up. If your father is a womanizer and a wife abuser, beat your mother up, that's going to affect you. If you're on an airplane and the captain is drunk, in the case of one I just saw, the captain let his little girl sit in the seat to fly the airplane, and she turned the airplane with a stick, took the autopilot off. The plane, they couldn't recover the plane as it stalled, and it flew straight into the ground. Well, those people on the plane were innocent. The captain was negligent, and he killed a bunch of people. Folks, that's the way life is. That's why a long time ago I decided to turn my life over to Jesus, because I can't stop all the injustices in the world. Anything could kill me in the next instant. Somebody doing something stupid that is not my fault, but I still die anyway. All right, in verse 6, we see that Moses said, there shall be a great cry, such as there has not been before, or such as shall never be again. Now, we can't take that literally. This is Hebrew hyperbole. Let me give you another example of this, Matthew 24:21. Jesus is speaking in the Olivet Discourse, and he says, for then there will be great tribulation. This is in Matthew 24:21. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now. No, and never will be. Exactly the same type of Hebrew language. Now, the great tribulation that Jesus mentioned, the famines and the plagues, there was tribulations worse than that. He said, never has there ever been a tribulation like this before. Yes, there was. If you want to interpret that literally, Noah's flood wiped out the whole world. So you see, that's just exaggeration. There's a lot of other examples too, which I haven't bothered to look up. Preterists love this verse because they love to say, see there, the great tribulation is not the worst tribulation that ever happened. The futurist vision of the future great tribulation is not the worst that's ever happened. And likewise here, this cry in Egypt is just going to be terribly awful. Doesn't necessarily mean it's the worst thing that ever happened to Egypt. Could be, but not necessarily. Some people have speculated, well, maybe the destruction of Pharaoh's army was worse than the cry of the mourners over the firstborn being dead. Well, let's think about that. Drowning in the Red Sea, the army drowned, yeah, that was pretty bad loss. It was a military loss. But the killing of the firstborn, the death of the firstborn, that was a personal loss. Everybody lost their personal son. Also, more families were affected by the plague. The slave girl by the millstone, she probably didn't have somebody in the army, or perhaps did not have someone in the army. So there were more families that were affected by the death of the firstborn than the families were affected by the Egyptian soldiers getting drowned in the Red Sea. And the fact that the Pharaoh got killed in the drowning at the Red Sea probably didn't bother the Egyptians too much. They'd just get another Pharaoh. And besides, hadn't that Pharaoh put them through all the plagues against their will? Remember in Exodus 10:7, then Pharaoh's servant said to him, how long shall this man be a snare to us? Let the men go, that they may serve the Lord their God. Do you not yet understand that Egypt is ruined? So that was bad, but that wasn't as bad as the 10th plague. This 10th plague was very, very bad, but we don't want to take that literally again. Such as has never been before. Well, the worldwide plague would have wiped out Egypt too. The worldwide flood, I'm sorry, would have wiped out Egypt too. And so that would have been worse than the firstborn dying. So don't get hung up on hyperliteralism. We go now to Exodus 11, verses 7 and 8. But against any of the sons of Israel, a dog will not even bark, whether against man or beast, that you may understand how the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. All these your servants will come down to me and bow themselves before me, saying, Go out, you and all the people will follow you. And after that, I will go out. And he went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. He means after the people say, Get out of Egypt. Moses says, I'm going to get out of Egypt. Then he went out from Pharaoh. Went out twice, I guess. He went out first from Pharaoh, then he went out from Egypt. But against any of the sons of Israel, a dog will not even bark, Moses said. And that's just a proverbial expression. A dog barking against you, that's not a big deal. That's not a big deal. But not even that's going to happen because the Israelites are going to be totally safe. Their firstborn will not die. Adam Clark says this expression, a dog won't even bark against you, is a proverbial expression. Now, you could take it literally and say that when the Israelites left in the middle of the night, no one would harm them. But, I mean, think about it. 600,000 people living in the middle of the night, dogs are going to bark. So this is not meant to be taken literally. It's a proverbial expression. It's not meant to be taken literally. Verse 8, Moses says, he's still talking to Pharaoh now. He says, all these your servants, he's talking about the Egyptian government officials. He probably points to them when he says, all these your servants will come down to me and bow themselves before me, saying, Go out, you and all the people will follow you. Go out, get out of here, will say the Egyptian officials. This was an accurate prediction by Moses because in Exodus 12, the next chapter, verses 31 and 33, we read this. Then he, that's Pharaoh, called for Moses and Aaron at night and said, Rise up, get out from among my people. Get out of here, both you and the sons of Israel, and go worship the Lord as you have said. Take both your flocks and your herds as you have said, and go and bless me also. Verse 33, Exodus 12. The Egyptians urged the people to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, We will all be dead. So the Egyptian officials urged, I think that means urged the Hebrew slaves, the Hebrews, to get out. Or it could mean the Egyptian officials urged the Egyptian people to send the Hebrews out. I'll have to think about that. But when we get to the next chapter, I'll look into that. The Egyptians urged the people to send them out of the land in haste. We will all be dead. Actually, that's an excited exaggeration because actually just the firstborn would be dead. But the Egyptians didn't know that. All they see is they see their children dying all over the country. And so they assume, well, it's only going to get worse. So we better get these Hebrew slaves out of here. Now, when Moses predicts this, now again, this is a prediction that hasn't happened yet, happens in the next chapter, that the Egyptian officials will say, get out of here. The Egyptians will tell the Hebrew slaves to get lost. That's going to happen in the next chapter. In this chapter, Moses is still talking to the Pharaoh, and then he leaves the Pharaoh in hot anger. Now, first of all, we need to look at this anger. First of all, who's got hot anger? Well, this translation, I'm using the NASB, it's Moses went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. Apparently, you could translate it such that Pharaoh left Moses in hot anger. John Gill opposes that idea. So we're going to assume this is Moses who left in hot anger. Now, the next question is did he sin? No, he did not sin. Righteous indignation is not sin. Jesus got angry at the Pharisees and he did not sin. Paul told the Ephesians, be angry, but sin not. So anger per se is not a sin. That's always something that used to catch me up. I guess all Christians kind of think about that a little bit because usually anger is very bad. It leads to bad results, but not all anger is sin. Righteous indignation is perfectly okay. Jesus never sinned, but he got righteously indignant. We go to Exodus 11, 9 and 10, and we'll finish up. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh will not listen to you so that my wonders would be multiplied in the land of Egypt. So the bad news is Pharaoh's not going to listen. The good news is that gives God an occasion to do some miracles that are going to be talked about for 3,500 years or so in the future until motion pictures are invented and Cecil B. DeMille will make the great movie, The Ten Commandments. And we're going to know all about the 10 plagues on Egypt. Verse 10. Exodus 11, Moses and Aaron performed all these wonders before Pharaoh, yet the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the sons of Israel go out of his land. I mean, Moses threatens to kill his firstborns. I mean, surely Pharaoh had enough sense to know that Moses could carry out his threats. He's done so in the previous 9 plagues, but he was so hard. He was so stupid. He says, okay, well, let's just keep going with this. And as a result, he lost his firstborn son, probably the heir to the throne. Now, it says the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, but as I've said many times before, 9 times We see the Lord hardening Pharaoh's heart in the story of the 10 plagues, and 9 times we see that Pharaoh hardened his own heart. God did not take a sweet and innocent and non-culpable Pharaoh and turn him into a criminal by hardening his heart. No, God hardened Pharaoh's heart as punishment for the previous hardening of Pharaoh's heart, which he had already done. So this was completely just, and we need not get hung up over the fact that it looks like God is making Pharaoh responsible for his sin. No, Pharaoh was responsible for his sin. He was a moron. He was an immoral moron. He deserved to have his heart hardened. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Exodus 11. This prepares us now for Exodus 12, our next audio. We are going to cover the first 28 verses of Exodus 12, and we will look at the institution of that very famous Jewish ordinance, the Passover. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.